Thank
you. I'd like that very much, Ben.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to...
Good morning.
And welcome to today's meeting of the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. Musical interludes occasionally provided. The agenda today is two informational hearings, one on House Bill 3472, which is the Pay It Forward / Tuition Freeze Bill from 2013 session, and... I'm right about that. You all right? And also another one on the progress of the HEC Financial Aid Work Group. I would like to begin by opening an informational hearing on House Bill 3472. And we have testimony from, I believe, Ben Cannon. You want to start it off, sir? You want anyone up with you? Or
We'll have, for the record, Mr. Chair, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and my words will be very brief, just to sort of introduce both topics. The HEC was charged by the last legislature to examine, of course, the tuition freeze and the pay it forward concept that you'll hear about momentarily. We are being charged by this legislature to examine free community college. You'll hear about work that we are doing to examine the Oregon Opportunity Grant and potential changes to that. You'll hear about that today. We'll be investigating opportunities that may be created by voters this fall if the Treasurer's Opportunity Initiative that you referred last session passed. I just wanted to provide that context and say that's a big chunk of what we're up to over the next 6 to 9 months, and we intend to bring to you next legislative session recommendations, priorities around those ideas. So what you'll hear is very much work in progress led by two of our very able commissioners and the staff support that they've had. Look forward to your input. We don't have recommendations for you today, but certainly by the start of next session, you'll be hearing sort of what the commission's priorities are around those issues and other topics. Just to be clear, the goal of pay it forward, of redefining the Oregon Opportunity Grant, would be to make a dent in the access and affordability issue for students. To do any of that, Opportunity Grant, Pay It Forward, Opportunity Initiative from the Treasurer Free Community College would require investment. We think in addition to making additional investment in higher education to make a dent in affordability, it's also going to be really important to look at the investments that we are making within current dollars and how can we better and more effectively spend those dollars as well. So sort of two separate questions. You'll hear about one of them today. Thanks.
Mr. Chair. Yes. Thank you for that introduction, Mr. Cannon. I sat with a young lady last night at a speech competition event. She's 16 years old, and she's in high school, but she's also registered Chemeketa. And her plan is when she's 18, she'll finish her high school in 2 years of community college. So that's the sort of thing that we've done we can be proud of and need to look at more things like that, too. I hope the HEC will look at all the things like that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ben. Let's see. We have Rob Fulmer and Donna Llewellyn. Please decide who's going first and introduce yourselves for the record.
Good morning, Chair Harker. Representatives. For the record, my name is Rob Fulmer. I'm the chair of the Pay It Forward Work Group of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So we have a PowerPoint, and I'm going to embellish so you can both read and follow along with what I say. But the Pay It Forward Work Group met for the first time in January, and we met again in February. And our charge, as you know, is to determine in a pilot a valid system for having students be able to attend college and not incur this giant amount of debt that they're currently facing. This says that it would replace the current system of tuition and fees. That's one way to look at it. And another way that's helpful is universities obviously need revenue to operate. So this would not sort of set aside the necessity for that revenue to be paid to universities. But what it would do instead is it would pay this out of a fund at the beginning, and then through after students had attended, they would at some future point after they had completed their studies, they would pay a small percentage of their earnings. And so we've been asked to find a mechanism through which this could take place and be viable into the future. So we've been working on that problem. I wanted to just underscore that the work group's work is to try and find out to determine a viable way to make this happen, and then it's the responsibility of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission as a whole to make a recommendation to the legislature based on our findings in the work group. So we're just trying to determine a model that will make this a determination of whether or not this can happen successfully, and then the heck as a whole will be the ones that decide whether or not to make that recommendation. So with that, the work group membership consists of commissioners, several of the participants in the original PSU capstone, which I think made a presentation in front of various legislators in the 2013 session. It has community representatives. It has representation from institutional financial aid officers. It also has experts from the Treasury Department and OSAC, and it has affordability researchers, both local within Oregon and within the region. And with it, it's a very strong group. They bring a great deal of expertise to this area. So. Just a little bit of context about Pay It Forward. As I think most of you are aware, we are kind of at the...
May we interrupt as we go, or how do you want to do it?
Sorry?
Can we ask questions as we go?
I'm fine with that.
Yes, if you are, then I certainly am. Is it Dr. Fulmer?
Yeah, no. Just commissioner.
Commissioner, thank you. Can we get a list of all the people? They're
absolutely, yeah.
Are they assigned, but your other people join you?
To fill the commission, we chose people who were on various sides of the issue. We have people who think that Pay It Forward is a great idea, and we also have people who aren't nearly as sure that Pay It Forward is a good idea. We want to make sure that we have all viewpoints, because in having all viewpoints, you get the perspective that may make you re-examine issues and come up with better solutions.
Thank
so we are really looking to make sure that all perspectives are well represented in this group.
Thank you.
It's not just a bunch of people who think it's great.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question. Okay, so to continue, we have the Pay It Forward idea. I think it's an idea whose time has come. As you may or may not be aware, originally introduced, I think, about 20 years ago, it has been tried at various institutions in some form or another, but the student debt situation has reached unsustainable levels, as Executive Director Cannon mentioned, we're looking at all kinds of options to approach that problem and solve it. So anyway, bills have been introduced in both the House of Representatives and the Senate to address this issue by Senator Merkley and by Representative Bonamici. And those bills are nearly identical. Have a few that obviously neither of them has been passed. They've just been introduced at this point. But they were helpful in guiding our work. We didn't consider ourselves to be sort of bound by them. But at the same time, they set some parameters for what we expect would be considered reasonable in terms of the percentages of future adjusted gross income and things like that. We don't, while the bills have a provision in them that grant broad discretion to the Secretary of Education in terms of waiving a particular parts of them as required in order to meet to best pick pilots that they think meet the goals of Pay It Forward. We didn't want to come up with a plan that was completely at odds with what was in those national bills. So that was something that we took into consideration. Also, there, as it says up there, there are 19 states now that are looking at Pay It Forward. So this is obviously an idea that is being looked at very broadly because, again, the student debt situation has reached such serious proportions. Okay, we've also had testimony from community members and high school students before the work group, and I would just say that the level of interest is extremely high, and it's been overwhelmingly positive in terms of the concept. Students have testified to us that they have dropped out of college because they can't afford to pay for it anymore. And this is a mechanism through which, and it has nothing to do with academic achievement. It has to do with debt and risk. Right? I mean, if you encumber a giant debt, you're taking on a giant risk. And there are students who don't feel that that risk is one that they are willing to make. Anyway, so our approach in the Pay It Forward work group has been to start by figuring out what our principles are. Like, what are the fundamental things that we're trying to established with this pilot design that would meet the needs of both the state in reaching its 40-40-20 goals and the students. And so these are the principles that we arrived at. We are trying to avoid undue burdens on students. That's the system that we have now. If we don't get to there, then we're not making much of an improvement. We're also stipulating that the program be voluntary. So no student will be obligated to participate and Pay It Forward. Most importantly, I think, maybe, is student-friendly. We want a pilot that is going to be easy to use, easy to understand, and work well for students. So the state's role. The Pay It Forward program is not intended to be the sole or primary vehicle through which college is paid for. And
Mr. Fulmer?
Yes.
Excuse me, we have another question or comment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Thank you, my attention.
No,
yeah, just interrupt me. I'm good.
Commissioner, thank you. Your first principle of for students, avoiding undue burden.
Yes.
I would suggest, because you made a statement earlier that the objective, you were talking off the cuff, I think we're off script, but you said college without debt. I don't know how we get college without debt. Someone's going to have a debt. I would suggest that avoiding undue burdens would be replaced, will make college more affordable, which increases access.
Representative Wisniewski, Chair Harker. I believe that I may have overstated when I said college with that. I mean, I think that is the ideal, right? I mean, the ideal.
No,
is that,
it doesn't pencil out. Someone has a debt. Either taxpayers or someone has a debt. You can't.
College has to be paid for.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would agree.
It has to be paid for along the way.
Yeah.
It's a debt.
My kids had the great fortune of going through college with no debt.
Scholarships.
No, I paid for it.
The debt was to the
family. And I was in the very fortunate position of not having to borrow, so no debt.
But I think
I went through college without debt because the tuition was affordable that I could work in
summers
and pay my way through. I mean, it is possible to go without debt if we make it affordable.
Yeah, and I do want to just sort of take this opportunity, if I may, to say that the Pay It Forward program, I think one of the things that's most attractive about it is that it's not a loan.
right? I mean, the pay it forward is the idea is that a fund would pay for their attendance, and then they would pay a small percentage of future income. So it's kind of like reverse Social Security if you think about it. I mean, you don't think
reverse mortgage.
Okay, but anyway, so I hope that we've come to a meeting of the minds, sir, on that.
Mr. Chair, I support the bill, the study, and I hope we'll come up. But those are I really, you know, the statement when you made it was about debt, and whether you paid that without going into debt, you paid a lot of money, your father, your work, your whatever. So I think my goal when I signed onto this bill was to make college more affordable, which I think increases access.
I think that we share that goal.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, so with that said, okay. So the pilot, as we say, would remove barriers to access. Our communications that we've gotten from the community have been very supportive of that idea. In terms of participation duration, we've thought very carefully about that issue because we want students to be able to, and this alludes to the last bullet point on the same slide. We want students to be able to participate in a program that is realistic about their lives. There are college students who have childcare needs. Not everybody can attend full time, and we want the Pay It Forward pilot model to be cognizant of that and to accommodate it to the best degree possible. We also want to make sure that we learn from what others are doing. This is a little tricky because we're kind of out in front a little bit, but we do want to be mindful. And I would say that's one way that we do that is by looking at the national legislation that I mentioned before. We have looked carefully at eligibility. We want to make sure that we scope this to students that are seeking a degree or certificate, not people who are just taking classes, you know, after or as part of their ongoing education. We want it to be scalable in a way that would allow it to be rolled out much more broadly should a pilot be undertaken and successful. All right. So the next steps, we were hoping to have our funding guy, Mike Salvaggio from Treasury, come and talk to us about how we might seed the fund to pay for this at our last meeting, but that didn't work out, so he's going to come to our next one. So I can't tell you in any detail how we're going to come up with the funding should a pilot be proposed and go forward. But we are going to be looking at that. We're going to be refining and finalizing program recommendations, and there's some questions about collection, and we need to. This isn't a loan, as I was saying before. It's more of a contract that a student would sign in order to participate in the program. So we have to look carefully at how we would collect on that, and whether or not that could be done through the personal income tax mechanism or alternative. But there's also the issue of students that get their education in Oregon and leave the state. I can't imagine why anyone would want to do that, but we want to make sure that we have mechanisms in place to collect from students who would leave the state of Oregon after graduation. And finally, we want to make sure that we learn from the pilot. It's important that in any pilot, the whole idea is to gather as much information as possible so that you can extrapolate from what you've done to figure out what's likely to happen if you roll it out on a wider scale. And so we're looking very carefully at rolling it out in such a way, should a pilot be done, that it would be most informative in terms of determining whether or not we should move forward with a larger model. So with that, I think...
Yes, of course. Please.
I was just going to open it up for questions.
Well, I want to relate specifically to the question about the nature of a pilot. As a researcher, I think you need to be cautious about what outcome measures you attempt to get. I mean, this is not... There is no possibility in a pilot that we could do that would really measure the long-term outcome of what it is we're talking about. And we don't know whether somebody 20 years from now is going to continue to be paying whatever it is they're supposed to be paying. So my sense of the basic nature of a pilot is that you're piloting your way through shoals, and if it worked all right, then people can follow you on that same path, or, whoops, that was a rock we hit, turn left here, follow that way. But it seems to me you need to be pretty cautious that you don't produce, you don't declare a set of outcome measurements that you can't possibly achieve. And that seems to me, I think you need to be pretty modest about it.
Representative Greenland, Chair Harker, I think that's excellent analysis, Representative Greenland, because you could do an outcome-based pilot, but then you'd have to take 30 years, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So I don't think we have that kind of time frame. The debt situation has not, for students, has not left us in a place where we have 30 years to come to it. But I do think that what you can do is you can see, you can put metrics in place to measure things that are in process, and as long as you measure iteratively, I think that it can be a good indicator of whether or not you're going to have success on a wider scale. But I think your remarks are right on spot.
I would say guard against grandiosity.
Always good advice. Other questions?
Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fulmer, are you familiar with some work that a professor back in Wisconsin's done, Professor Sarah Goldrick-Robb?
You know, the name sounds familiar, but I don't know if I've read her work or not.
I think she does a lot of work talking about college affordability and so forth, but she actually did a report for the Century Foundation on House Bill 3472 after it passed last session, but she said this, quote, "For many reasons, I think that this bill, House Bill 3472, will fail to live up to the high hopes of people advocating for it, and in the meantime, mollify and distract reformers from the hard work involved in finding a lasting solution to college debt." And therein lies, I think, some of my concerns, and I think some of the concerns of others, and I've shared these with Director Cannon and Tim Nesbitt and other HEC members, but, you know, the HEC has a limited bandwidth, and the HEC has been charged with, by us and others, with a significant workload. And many of these are on some very, very, some solutions that already have a lot of traction to them, i.e. expanding the opportunity grant, working on some funding incentives for outcomes on degree acquisition and so forth. And we have some very good tracks to run on. And my concern is that to have the HEC spend more time than would be necessary, at least giving this a cursory glance, is going to distract them from some very, very important work that I think Oregonians are hoping for, and then they're excited about the possibility of this. So, therefore, you know, I'm concerned about, again, just the distraction that this could become to the work that your commission comes up with and comes back to us with some real tangible ideas, again, building on models and building on tracks we've already established that can get us some results that students are really looking for in the short term.
Yeah, Representative Johnson, Chair Harker, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, there we have at several instances in the HEC looked at the scope of work to which we are charged and have been impressed at its breadth. At the same time, Working at Portland State University, where I'm an employee, I am used to running faster, as you may have heard the phrase. So I serve with Chair Roper on the Student Financial Aid Subcommittee and on the Greater HEC, and many other members of the HEC are also working on a variety of projects related to its mission. So I would say that even though we have a lot to do, I think we are very focused on doing all the things to which we are charged well. And I expect that Pay It Forward will be among those things.
Follow up?
Yes, and then we will go into the tuition freeze portion of this.
Okay. Thank you. I do have copies of the minutes, I think, from your last work group meeting. But in that, you did, you alluded to it in your testimony about the issue with collections. You know, it's one thing to afford a benefit to someone where they can attend debt-free, so to speak, but then how does the system recoup that? And you make mention in here that you'd love for the IRS to be involved. And at some degree, it does seem like we're going to have some large expansion of governmental oversight to go follow these students wherever they may migrate over the course of the 25 or 30 years after they graduate or after they move on, or maybe they don't even reach completion. Maybe they attend for a year, maybe two, but yet they're still going to have to pay back in some fashion for that period of time that they spent on the clock, if you will, without having any skin in the game. So there are just some really daunting issues here that need to be examined, and I'm sure you appreciate that. But again, I think this is it's a shiny object. I agree, but in terms of its just the feasibility of it, it's just very hard for me to see how this can even get to any sort of rational, reasonable presentation.
Representative Johnson, Chair Harker. I want to say, first of all, that I appreciate very much that you have been through the work group notes. I'm going to have to make sure that I express myself very carefully in those in the future. But I would also say that in those notes that you should be made aware that I have worried about the collection problem very much in both sessions and in sort of thinking about this problem generally. One of the things that you may have seen mentioned in there, I don't know if Donna included them in the notes, was the idea of we do have a mechanism to collect on people who do not pay child support out of state. So that already exists, and I know that it's not apples and oranges to some extent, but while it would be, I think, ideal to have the federal government and the IRS involved in our collections, because if there's some reciprocity with other states and other arrangements to that effect, that makes it much easier for us in terms of what we have to do in the state of Oregon. But we do have some mechanisms in place to approach that kind of problem, and we're going to be looking at to what extent those could be applied in this case.
All right. Very good. Thanks for the discussion.
Mr. Chair, one last.
Okay, we have
I'm
30 minutes to get through two-thirds of our
I'm just going to ask if we can get have the committee administrator receive the minutes of their working group, and she can distribute it to them.
Good idea. Thanks.
He's going to scold me now. He scolded me longer than the question was.
I'm scolding us. All right.
You deserve
if
it.
You could, Donna, if you could take about 10 minutes, that would be great so that we don't leave your chair without any time here, okay?
Thank you, Representative Chair Harker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Donna Lewelling. I am the policy analyst for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I will be speaking with you in regards to House Bill 3472, Section 3 of the bill that talked about the tuition freeze report. The Section 3 of the bill required the HEC to conduct a study of the successful implementation of tuition freezes at public universities. It required the analysis of Western Oregon University Tuition Promise, as well as Florida's Finish in 4 proposal. It also asked the HEC to consider the mitigation of financial strain on public institutions. I'd like to set a little bit of a national context, talk to you a little bit about Florida's Finish in Four proposal. Florida Governors Rick Scott in 2013-14 recommended budget included a proposal known as Finish in Four. The foundation of the proposal was a guarantee that the student enrollment or student enrolled in a state university and attended full-time, that their tuition and fees would be fixed for 4 years. The proposal was introduced via Florida Senate Bill 920. However, the bill did not pass. The Florida legislature later went on and passed a budget with a 3% tuition hike for institutions. As expected, Governor Scott vetoed the tuition increase. In addition, the HEC decided to look at activities in Texas surrounding tuition freeze. Texas is approaching tuition costs through fixed tuition plans and a competency-based bachelor's degree. The Texas Affordable Baccalaureate Program, which is launching in spring 2014, allows students to pay a flat 7-week rate and complete as many courses as possible during that time. Advancement in the degree is based upon proof of competency.
Say 7 week?
Yes, that's what my research showed. The program intends a reduced time in completion with 80% completion and retention rates while reaching sustainability within 5 years. As you know, families who are looking to plan for financial education often find institutions with tuition freezes appealing as it allows for a more accurate assessment for budgetary planning. When tuition freezes are instituted, students do not experience an increase in tuition during the 4-year period, which may lead to a reduced student debt load. While it's thought that these programs also incent graduation in 4 years and reduced rate of student transfers, national data regarding these issues is currently not available. Whether the current crop of tuition freezes holds through next year or whether it spreads to other states remains to be seen. Several states have had to or have held tuition down for the past few years, such as Maryland, but have also approved tuition increases for this year. There are efforts in Oregon. As directed, the HEC also looked at Western Oregon University's tuition promise as well as Portland State University's 4-year degree. Upon enrollment, Western Oregon provides new undergraduate, Oregon resident, and Western undergraduate exchange students with a choice between standard tuition rates or the guarantee that their tuition rates will remain unchanged for 4 academic years. Portland State University's 4-year guarantee will be beginning in fall term 2014, and for those students who sign an agreement with Portland State University, they will be guaranteed access to required courses necessary to graduate with their identified 4-year degree. Under the agreement, full-time freshmen who maintain good academic standing and meet requirements for their majors will be provided academic ed advising and the required courses for each year. And just as a reminder, during last legislative session, the legislature did appropriate $40 million to the Oregon University system for tuition freeze. In addition, $15 million was appropriated for the Oregon Community College system. So there has been an investment in Oregon for this. Next, I'd like to talk to you about the findings and preliminary recommendations.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative.
So real quick, and before except the last subject, we were talking about the different programs. In this committee, we also discussed the $10,000 degree, I think.
The 10 KVA representative, wasn't it? Yes.
Yes, ma'am. And also, I would encourage you, the chair, Mr. Nesbitt, was a sponsor several sessions ago of the shared responsibility model. I would ask you to consider that, too. And as I spoke earlier, I think it's still some really good things to do with a high school college credit courses that we need to look at that in your looking at trying to bring costs down, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have time. And
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Chair Harker.
All right. So our findings and recommendations are the following. Institutions nationally report that state funding support is instrumental in ensuring that the costs associated with the third and fourth year of a tuition freeze program are not passed on to incoming students. Without additional state funding support for universities, a tuition freeze will likely result in increased tuition charges for incoming freshmen, which may actually detour students from attending a university their freshman year, which ultimately would make them ineligible for participating in a tuition freeze program. Once data becomes available from states that have recently implemented tuition freezes and additional state funding resources become available, a more in-depth study could be conducted regarding the effectiveness of tuition freezes in reducing student debt and increasing on-time student completion rates. Tuition freezes may take a variety of forms. They may include a pricing strategy such as the tuition promise, or a state commitment to enhanced resources designed to moderate or freeze tuition increases. For example, the 2013 tuition buy-down. As the HEC begins its strategic journey on the pathways to progress, it plans to continue to organize its work around the importance of making post-secondary education accessible and affordable for all Oregonians. Continued conversations regarding acceleration to degree completion, student debt reduction, and post-secondary funding models will keep student affordability and access at the forefront of statewide and institutional conversations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you, and I'll completely understand if you don't have this information, but when you talk about the buy-down that we were happily able to provide last year, can you refresh my memory, or maybe someone else can, on how that money got distributed?
So, Representative, or Chair Harker, members of the committee, I don't have that in front of me. What I can tell you, it was I can tell you for the for the university systems, mm-hmm. my notes show that it was distributed based on foregone revenues associated with the rate reductions in year one. And year two is proposed to be allocated on a basis proportionate with the each campus's percentage of the total resident tuition revenues in 2013-14.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments for these two commissioners? Representative,
it'll be short.
Haven't heard from you in a while.
Since I haven't given you enough, thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you haven't given you enough, I've been tracking this and really working on this. There was a Los Angeles Times article I'll provide you that talked about how students are now going to Europe to get cheaper education and graduating in 3 years. So I'll provide you that data. That's another thing for you. It's on your plate.
Thank you.
I think that's because they can have beer and wine before the age of 21.
I think you're right.
Next because there's no sports teams.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you both very much. So I will now close the informational hearing on House Bill 3472 and open an informational hearing on financial aid work group. And I believe we have Mr. Larry Roper here. Welcome, sir. Identify yourself for the record and guide us along.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. I'm Larry Roper. I chair the HEC financial aid work group.
Welcome.
Thank you. So before I start, I'd just like to provide a little context. Before the context, I really want to thank this body for the increased attention that's been given to students' access and affordability. You know, as someone who was a first-generation college goer and someone who spent nearly 40 years working in higher education, I can tell you this is an issue that's central in the lives of students and something for which I know students, when they hear that these conversations are occurring, are incredibly appreciative. So thank you very much. So with the presentation I have, there are a few things I'd like to be able to accomplish. First is just to provide an update in terms of the progress of our work. Second, hopefully to give you some insight into the issues with which we're still wrestling. Obviously, this is a very complex and challenging issue, and we want to really give honor to the fact that there are some complex and challenging things that we're going to have to really work hard to figure out. And in the process also describes what we think as both the challenges and the promise associated with the current opportunity grant program and that program as we go forward. And then obviously to invite your thoughts that will both enrich and stimulate our work as we go forward. So what I've done, I've tried to provide some slides that will sort of walk you through some aspects of the work that we're doing to give you the overview, but hopefully not take you too deeply into the weeds. And you should have before you a copy of the charge of the work group. And as you know, the charge is really stimulated by interest within the legislative body about the opportunity grant and the investment and what that means. And so as a result, OEIB took that issue and took it to HEC, which then issued a charge to the work group. The work group was appointed, and we began our work in November. And since that time, we've had seven public meetings. You will see before you a copy of the charge. And if we could distill the charge down to anything, I would say that our charge is to interrogate our current system and to determine the efficacy of that system and to determine how we align that system with the goals of the state in terms of 40-40-20, as well as a commitment to access to higher education by those who are most challenged to both access and complete higher education. And so we, through our process, have invited testimony, presentations, and I'll talk about some of the testimony and presentations we've had. And we're at the stage now, we're working on some preliminary recommendations, and I've included some of those toward the end of the presentation for your awareness and insight. And so as we went along, We analyzed our current status of our funding policies, implementation, and procedures. And this work was very essential to this work was the work of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And I have to acknowledge Bob Brew, who's the interim executive director of OSAC, who's here today. And if we get into numbers issues, you will hear his voice. Okay. We will invite him to the table. I'm not allowed to have the checkbook at home, so anything involving numbers, I defer to others. We also considered some partner presentations to inform our work, and those partner presentations were very important because they provide us with insight into some promising practices that are currently underway at some of our institutions in terms of how they're leveraging aid, and leveraging aid with student support programs to ensure not just access, but that there's success in promotion of students navigating the university experience. And those presentations were from the OSU Bridge to Success program, the U of O Pathways program. We also heard from the Treasurer's Office on their proposal for a student opportunity grant. And as I said, we heard a number of presentations from OSAC. We developed and approved a set of 14 foundational principles, and I'll share with you some of those high-priority foundational principles. We completed a questionnaire, which allowed us to sort through all of the muck and mire and to begin to distill some of the top-level issues that we needed to form the basis of our work and our design. And then February 14, we had a half-day retreat. That was where we were joined by Nate Johnson from the Strategy Lab, which is a group that's supported by the Lumina Foundation, to come with us and really to bring us some of the most promising practices from states across the country. And that work was incredibly illuminating and really helped us to hone where we were in our work. And so if we just look at the preliminary work group analysis, we find that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is underfunded to meet the current needs of to support student progress toward 40-40-20. For example, and I'll have a chart that follows this slide, of the 155,000-plus eligible students in 2012-13, 34,000 or so received the grant. And this is a case where the grant was distributed on a first-come, first-served basis. We went through and looked at sort of our current allocation methodology in light of the student access and success and funding levels. One of the things we concluded is that the shared responsibility model and this vision for affordability is a strong concept. that the efficacy of that as a concept is very strong. Our challenge is how do we get that in alignment with our actual practices in order to ensure that it really is as robust as defined. And then we, as a group, we resolved that based upon the complexity of the issues that we would present a proposal in our final report that would essentially be two-tiered. One would be based upon here are the funds we have available, here are the outcomes that we think are most achievable, and then the other piece would be, and here's our aspirations for the future, and here's what it would take to ramp up where we are to where we would go. And so to try to reconcile both the realistic and the ideal. And particularly as that relates to 40-40-20. So as I shared, said, we would offer you just sort of a preliminary graph of what's happened with the opportunity grant. And if you see the top bar line is are OOG eligible. And then the lines below that are award levels, award numbers. And so you can see there's a significant gap between those who are eligible and those who actually receive the grant. And obviously, you know, the goal, our ideal goal, is to have there be no gap. That if, in fact, our shared responsibility model suggests that there's a relationship that we want. Yes.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
So, Chair Harper,
one question for this. So this is all higher ed? This would include community colleges
yes,
as well?
Yes, this is all eligible.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so we our goal, ideally, is to eliminate the gap.
For you.
But if you look just sort of just if we look at the shared responsibility model and just take one sample, one sort of cross section of an analysis, and think about sort of the most needy student, and so this is would be a student that, based upon the FAFSA, would project zero family contribution. What we would find is that even with the student's contribution of $8,800. And the maximum Pell grant, that there will still be a remaining need of over $6,000. And so this is the type of dilemma, the type of situation with which we're often confronted in our work or in our effort to achieve the foundational values of the shared responsibility model. And so we started with 14 foundational principles. Through our ranking process, we identified sort of the highest priority principles among those. And the reason the principles were important was that it provided us with a way to align a group that was very diverse in their values and their perspectives. So you would imagine that when you bring a group together to talk about how limited dollars would be allocated across any number of populations or demographic groups, that's a pretty high stakes issue for some folks. And so we needed to have a way of saying, can we agree upon sort of a set of principles that will guide our work? And so we identified, obviously, that access is the highest priority, that we want to provide support for students who are historically underserved communities. The financial aid should have integrity, which means that it should be predictable for students and families. And part of our current challenge is that it's an unpredictable environment relative to the grant. That the plan will be durable, which means that they will know that it's reliable from year to year. So once you start that journey, you know that support will be there for you on that journey. That it will be both measurable and regularly evaluated. So at some point, that as we go in the future, that it will be data-driven to a greater degree than which it currently is. That it will be financially sustainable and scalable, and that's our goal, that once we build a model, can we scale it up as more resources become available or if more resources become available. And then that it will be equitable and respond to the student needs in different sectors of higher education. And so in our work, we really talked about public and private four-year institutions, two-year institutions, and then vocational and technical institutions, those institutions that stimulate the workforce that may not currently be represented in our model, but that can be and should be included.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, please. And so I am hoping that
very brief.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm hoping that we'll have 5 minutes or so for questions at the end, but please.
Yeah, now I'm a priest.
I'm interested in the support from historically underserved community. Is poverty an underserved community regardless of other factors?
Yes, yes. And you will see in our in the subsequent slides how we sort of began to slice through some of those issues.
Thank you.
So what are the slides that will come after this? So what we've tried to do is we've tried to take and tried to figure out what our outcomes are that we desire. And so our outcome really is to develop a grant program that will both achieve the goal of access to higher education and vocational and technical education for low-income and historically underserved, underrepresented students and stimulate achievement toward 40-40-20. So what we tried to take as sort of sometimes can be an either-or conversation and turn it into a how can we while at the same time conversation, which we find that most of the most vexing issues we do are actually those kinds of conversations. And so what I'll take you through are some of the dimensions that we thought were important to address and that we're trying to get at. So we try to think about who's the target audience for the grant program. And so we try to think about those whose odds of attainment are most enhanced by receiving the grant. And so it's that idea about how do we sort of bet on those students who have the greatest chances of being successful in higher education, those who have most need the financial support, those who meet enrollment criteria, and we could get into that if necessary. But that at each sector, there's enrollment criteria to get in, so those who are eligible to participate in our institutions. Historically underrepresented students. And then we really brought those students who have sort of, you know, high promise and high need. And how do we find that blend of students there? Initial criteria that we wanted to be a need-based eligibility, so those who are Pell eligible, those from historically underrepresented groups, those who have some equivalent credential that would allow them access to education. And then really it's about Oregon residents attending all the sectors of higher education that we've described and looked at. Award process, we've again tried to think that the highest priority go to low-income students who demonstrate promise for success. And then we will try to prioritize underrepresented students within those low-income students that we will fund the first year of attendance, and this has started to get into some of the complexity. And then the funding beyond the first year will be determined based upon meeting some progress or achievement benchmarks. And then beyond the second year, renewal will be based upon sort of ramped up or escalated criteria for success or performance. And then that we will combine the grant with other sources of aid. And then that we will have an institutional appeal process for those who have particular life situations or extenuating circumstances that may affect their progress toward the degree. In terms of rewards size, that the awards will reflect shared responsibility, so we will try to balance the various sources of fund. And then it will be variable amounts based upon the needs of students with an established maximum that's going to be benchmarked to the cost of attendance, the cost of education. One of the findings that we had, one of the questions we went into our retreat with, is what is a meaningful grant? And what we found is that there is sort of no threshold for what constitutes a meaningful grant, but meaningful will be varied by the circumstances of the students and the needs of the students. And so the areas that we are still exploring, based upon all the dimensions, is we still want to deal with the issues of predictability and how do we design it for predictability, how do we deal with sort of deadline process issues, how do we build incentives into it, and then how do we align this program with other sources of aid? And with that, I would welcome questions.
Well done. Very informative. Since this is about finances and financial aid, I want to say that I noted in each of the three areas that we heard about today, phrases popped out at me. One was identify funding sources. Another was state funding, key to success. Third one was programs underfunded. So I've been here for about 6 years, and we have made progress in raising the visibility of higher education. And I mean, that's in no small part due to the now senator who is in the back of the room and the hard work of many of the people in this room. And I feel we have done well there. We were fortunate to have been able to provide the funding for the all of the funding that we were able to provide last year, including the additional $40 million and $15 million to the community colleges for buying down tuition. But the challenge is yet before us. The work that your group is doing is really key to affordable access, providing affordable access to all sorts of kids who whose parents can't provide tuition for them. And I greatly appreciate what you're doing and the energy you're bringing to it. And while I hate seeing these phrases each time, I'm really glad you keep telling us, okay? This has to be in our face all the time that we need to provide funds as a state to the state's higher education institutions. And I'll rest there and see what other questions or comments the rest of the committee might have. And you have to have some because I saved some time for them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, thank you.
Your comments are very apropos, and I think I've probably voted against the higher ed budget every session mm-hmm. I've been here through my successions because
that's
I
a lot
felt
of money.
Our extraordinary underfunding of the higher ed system essentially hampers our state moving, mm-hmm. moving forward. But sometimes people ask me why I built windmills. My answer is that sometimes windmills turn into dragons and you have a fighting chance to slay them at that case. And this is one where I think this windmill is beginning to turn into a dragon. That doesn't make it any easier to deal with this fire-breathing dragon, but it gives you a sense that there's some possibility. I think the answer is we have to begin funding higher education at a different level.
Yeah.
I mean, at a big, big different level, not an extra $10 million. And I don't know how we get there, but I think everybody working on it reminding us that there's no soup stone. I mean, we need to have some meat and potatoes and vegetables and all that, and we're not going to have soup that we're willing to live with. And this has such significant long-term consequences. So I'm really happy to hear these reports. I'm happy to hear
absolutely.
The director and the HEC who understands this as an issue, and that we have some very dedicated HEC members that are spending a ton of their time trying to help us out.
Well said. Yeah, thank you all for your service in this direction. Anything else, team?
Nope. No meeting Monday, right?
No, we've got meeting Sunday morning at 8 a.m.
Oh, excellent.
Right. I was hoping. No, no, I'm mistaken about that.
Can we wear pajamas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the financial aid work group. Thank you, Commissioner Roper. And
that
no
is
more
too funny, Vic.
We do not have any more meetings scheduled of this August committee.
Oh,
thank you,
no.
One and all.
No,
we are adjourned.
Oh,
we are adjourned.
Oh,